It is impossible to overestimate the importance of this event on the boy's maturing sensibilities. Through the miraculous little windows that now gripped his nose, the world leaped into pristine focus, disclosing an infinity of detail, of color, of nuance, and of movement just when the screen of his mind was at its most receptive. One of the best features of his adult descriptive writing, an unsurpassed joy in things seen, dates back to this moment, while another, his abnormal sensitivity to sound, is surely the legacy of the myopic years that came before. Another revelatory experience occurred later that summer, and it was considerably less pleasant. Having an attack of asthma, I was sent off by myself to Moosehead Lake. On the stagecoach ride thither, I encountered a couple of other boys who were about my own age, but very much more competent and also much mischievous. They found that I was a foreordained and predestined victim, and industriously proceeded to make life miserable for me. The worst feature was that when I finally tried to fight them, I discovered that either one singly could not only handle me with easy contempt, but handle me so as not to hurt me much, and yet prevent my doing any damage whatever in return. The humiliation forced him to realize that his 2 years of bodybuilding had achieved only token results. No matter how remarkable his progress might seem to himself, by the harsh standards of the world he was still a weakling. There and then, he decided to join what he would later call the Fellowship of the Doers. If he had exercised hard before, he must do so twice as hard now. He must also learn how to give and take punishment. Accordingly, with my father's hearty approval, I started to learn to box. On 16 October 1872, the Roosevelt sailed to Liverpool on the first stage of another foreign tour, this time featuring Egypt and the Holy Land, with varied degrees of enthusiasm. Theodore Sr. was, as usual, full of cheery optimism. Having been appointed American Commissioner to the Vienna Exposition the following spring, he looked forward to an enjoyable winter cruising the Nile and the Mediterranean. His lazy wife was quite content to recline on deck chairs as on sofas at home or hammocks in the country. Bammy, already at 17 the family's surrogate mother, clumped about arranging everything with a certain grim enjoyment. The two youngest Roosevelts dreaded another year away from their friends, but for a while the excitement of an ocean voyage muted their complaints. Teddy, for his part, took a serious, almost professorial view of the trip. As proprietor of the Roosevelt Museum, he was determined to treat his visit to the Nile as a scientific expedition and had already printed a quantity of pink labels for the identification of specimens. His new spectacles had focused his general interest in animals to an almost total obsession with birds. Hitherto, his near sight had forced him to confine his observations to large, slow creatures that inhabited terra firma. Now he was able to record the ascent of hawks to ecstatic heights and sit for hours watching flocks of ibises settling on a distant island until the tops of trees would be whitened with immense multitudes perching on them. As Teddy turned 14, he blossomed into a grotesque flower of adolescence, offensive alike to eye, ear, and nostril. Mittie Roosevelt, fresh and crackling in her perpetual white silks and muslin, could hardly have contemplated him without despair. Apart from the owlish spectacles and snarling teeth, there was the overlong hair, its childish yellow darkening now to dirty blonde, the bony wrists and ankles, which protruded every day a little farther from his carefully tailored suit, the fingers stained with ink and chemicals, the clumsy movements and too quick reflexes. His voice had not so much broken as taken on a new undertone of harshness, while its shrill upper frequencies remained. Mittie described his laugh as a sharp, ungreased squeak, which almost crushed her eardrums. For much of the time, he reeked of the laboratory. On days when he had been disemboweling as well as skinning his specimens, it was best to stand upwind of him. Teddy alone seemed to be unaware of his eccentric appearance. Pestered fearfully by street boys in Liverpool, he assumed it was because he was a Yankee, and was puzzled by a shopkeeper's refusal to sell him, on sight, a full pound of arsenic. I was informed that I must bring a witness to prove that I was not going to commit murder, suicide, or any such dreadful thing before I could have it, he wrote in his new travel diary. Presumably a witness was found, for within a couple of days he was skinning some snipe and partridge. All the way south, through England and Europe, Teddy continued his scientific labors. Although he had a few words of praise for continental scenery, the mossy roofs and distant windmills of Belgium, the wild and picturesque hills of Switzerland, his viewpoint was on the whole chauvinistic. Railroads, museums, even sanitation systems were unfavorably compared with those of America. Not until Egypt hove over the Mediterranean horizon on 28 November 1872 did Titi respond emotionally to his surroundings. "How I gazed upon it! It was Egypt, the land of my dreams. Egypt, the most ancient of all countries. A land that was old when Rome was bright, was old when Troy was taken. It was a sight to awaken a thousand thoughts, and it did." His diary entries immediately became lengthy and enthusiastic. The descriptions of street life in Alexandria are as dense with visual detail and sound effects as film scenarios. Only in front of Pompey's Pillar did words fail him. "On seeing this stately remain of former glory, I felt a great deal, but I said nothing. You cannot express yourself on such an occasion." Passing through the Nile Delta en route to Cairo, Titi munched sugarcane and gazed in rapture at a multitude of exotic species. Humped, long-haired zebus, delicate waders, great flapping, shrieking zigzags, kites and vultures floating on spirals of hot air, water buffaloes wallowing in the chocolate mud. As soon as he arrived in the capital, he bought an ornithological directory and began to study Egyptian birds, whose habits I was able to watch quite well through my spectacles. From now on, the pages of his diary seemed to come alive with squawks and fluttering wings. Even when going the rounds of historic buildings, he searched every nook and cranny for birds, discovering swallows under the dome of Muhammad Ali's mosque and perfectly distinguishable species of geese in an ancient mosaic at Boulogh. There is evidence that this obsession with feathered creatures was something of a trial to the more normal members of the family. "When he does come into the room, you always hear the words bird and skin," little Corinne complained. "It certainly is great fun for him." Even the sweet-tempered Elliot revolted against having to share a hotel room with a brother who stored entrails in the basin. Theodore Sr., while sympathetic, was too wise a father to discourage his son's scientific tendencies. The career of natural historian, to which Titi was obviously headed, was a respectable one, if not as profitable as a partnership in Roosevelt and Son. No doubt his businessman's eye had already discerned that this absent-minded and unorthodox youth would be a disaster in the world of commerce, while questions of health and physical frailty would disqualify him from the army and navy. He could see, too, that Titi, for all his scholarly single-mindedness, had not retreated from life. The boy still exercised regularly, read a wide variety of books and poetry, and showed a healthy interest in people and places. Watching while he eagerly surveyed the Sahara from the summit of the Great Pyramid, or timed the contortions of a group of howling dervishes, or stared at a beautiful houri in a Cairo window, Theodore Sr. could relax, knowing that his son was educating himself. On 12 December 1872, the Roosevelts moved out of Cairo on the first stage of their cruise up the Nile. Their home for the next 2 months was to be a privately chartered dahabiyah. "It is the nicest, coziest, pleasantest little place you ever saw," Titi wrote in delight. There were, to Elliot's relief, individual staterooms for each member of the family, plus a spacious dining salon and a panoramic shaded deck. For all its modern trimmings, the vessel was little different from those that 4,000 years before had carried pharaohs from one palace to another. The dahabiyah's progress as they pushed south against the current was almost hypnotically slow. Often, when the weak wind died, the crew was obliged to wade ashore with tackle and haul the houseboat along. None of the Roosevelts seemed to have minded this oriental form of locomotion. They watched the bronzed backs of the fellaheen curving against the tow rope, listened to their curious crooning songs, and luxuriated in the brilliant sunshine, with never a moment's rain. Mitty in particular enjoyed herself. Traveling at speeds of 2 to 3 miles an hour exactly suited her temperament. She was also flattered by the attentions of 4 young Harvard men who had chartered another dahabiyah and were sailing upriver in convoy. Frequent stops enabled the children to explore riverside ruins and native villages. The first day on the Nile was a momentous one for Titi. He coordinated the lenses of his crooked spectacles and the sights of his battered rifle well enough to bag a small warbler. It was the first bird I ever shot, and I was proportionately delighted. Throughout the 1,200-mile trip to Aswan and back, Titi ecstatically watched and listened to birds on the wing, and then as ecstatically killed them. A total, according to his own vague estimate, of between 1 and 200. On Christmas Day, his father presented him with a double-barreled breech-loading shotgun, and the boy's delight knew no bounds. "He is a most enthusiastic sportsman," wrote Theodore Sr., "and has infused some of his spirit into me. Yesterday I walked the bogs with him at the risk of sinking hopelessly and helplessly for hours, but I felt that I must keep up with Titi." No matter how sluggish the pace of the dahabiyeh, he managed to keep busy all day long. After breakfast, he joined his younger brother and sister for 2 hours of lessons with Bammy. She discovered that Titi knew a great deal more than she did on most subjects. Later, he would put on a large pair of spectacles and swing his gun over his shoulder and start on whatever small donkey was provided at the place we had stopped, and ruthlessly lope over whatever object he had in view, the donkey almost invariably crowding between any other two who might be riding together. His habit, during these lopes, of allowing the loaded gun to bump and bounce about freely, aroused considerable nervousness among his fellow hunters. Throughout the broiling afternoons, Corrine recalled, he would sit under the canopy on deck, surrounded by the brown-faced and curious sailors, and skin and stuff the products of his sport. At sunset, when breezes cooled the desert, he would join the family in tours of the stupendous ruins that regularly drifted into view. One such expedition, early in the new year of 1873, shattered him. "In the evening we visited Harnack by moonlight. It was not beautiful only, it was grand, magnificent, and awe-inspiring. It seemed to take me back thousands of years, to the time of the pharaohs, and to inspire thought which can never be spoken, a glimpse of the ineffable, of the unutterable." With adolescent determination not to waste good purple prose, he repeated this entire passage, complete with ineffables and unutterables, in a letter to Aunt Annie 2 weeks later. Rather more characteristic of his mature humor is a postscript on Egyptian rural fashions. "I may as well mention that the dress of the inhabitants up to 10 years of age is nothing. After that, they put on a shirt descended from some remote ancestor and never take it off until the day of their death." The Roosevelts enjoyed their southward cruise so much that they were tempted, upon reaching the first Aswan Cataract, to continue on into the heartland of North Africa. But time was running out for Commissioner Roosevelt. He still had to escort his family through Palestine, Syria, Turkey, and Greece before reporting for duty on 1 May at the Vienna Exposition. Reluctantly, he gave the order to turn downstream. 6 days later, after one of those sudden changes of pace and scene in which Theodore Sr. delighted, the Roosevelts found themselves cantering on hired horses across the green fields of Palestine. They were accompanied on this leg of their grand tour by Nathaniel Thayer and August Jay, two of the young Harvard men they had met on the Nile. A pleased sense of adventure hung over the little party. Ahead of them lay a month's exploration of the Levant, most of it on horseback. Tonight would be spent in a monastery, and most of the next few days in a Jerusalem hotel. But after that, they planned to live like nomads, camping out in the wilderness. Toward sunset, the party arrived at its destination, the convent of Ramleh, about 15 miles inland from Jaffa. Theodore Sr. had made reservations here, but the monks took one look at his women and curtly announced there was no room. This was not the sort of biblical parallel he was looking for in the Holy Land, and he reacted with his usual aggressiveness. A long talk ensued, Titi reported. At last the monks said that they had rooms for the gentlemen, but that ladies could not go inside the inner walls. This difficulty was also overcome in time. A minor incident, perhaps, yet it haunts the imagination. 6 tired women and children, 2 bewildered students, a gate, a darkening landscape, scowling bearded faces, and, dominating the whole scene, 1 determined man. Time and again, Titi was convinced, by experiences like this, that his father was all-powerful and irresistible. That forceful talk, combined with personal charm, would vanquish any opposition. Riding on eastward the next day, Titi began to get the feel of his horse. "He has some Arab blood in him, and is very swift, pretty, and spirited." After so many summers spent on the placid back of an American pony, it was thrilling to crouch over this lean body as it drummed tirelessly across the plain. Mr. J was challenged to a race and beaten. In great good humor, T.D. galloped up to a ridge of hills and was suddenly confronted with Jerusalem. "Just what I expected it to be," he decided, "except that it was remarkably small." Apart from a single expression of awe on Calvary, T.D.'s account of his travels through Palestine and Syria is free of conventional piety. He bathed irreverently in the Jordan, what we should call a small creek in America, noted that bribery alone gained access to the birthplace of Christ, and killed two very pretty little finches in the vicinity of Abraham's oak. His pantheistic soul seems to have been stirred more by the bird-haunted glades around Jericho, the desolate grandeur of the Moab escarpment, and the ruins of Baalbek. They gave me the same feelings as to contemplate the mighty temples of Thebes. Other, more primitive emotions surged when he came across a pair of jackals outside Damascus. I had just given the gun to Boutros, the underdragoman, while I arranged my bridle, when the jackals came in sight, and he was off like a flash while I followed, shouting for my gun. He did not hear me and kept on. Boutros was on bad ground and could not get near the beasts. They separated, and I went after the largest, thinking to ride over him and then kill him with a club. On we went over hills and through gullies, where none but a Syrian horse could go. I gained rapidly on him, and was within a few yards of him when he leaped over a cliff some 15 feet high, and while I made a detour around, he got in among some rocky hills where I could not get at him. I killed a large vulture afterwards. Apart from a cat he had shot near Jaffa, in mistake for a rabbit, this was his first attempt to hunt animals for sport rather than science. Toward the end of the Roosevelt's Levantine wanderings, T.D. recorded his first bad attack of asthma and cholera morbus, since leaving America 5 months previously. It was brought on by a freezing night in the mountains of Lebanon, and no doubt served to remind him that his battle for health was still not won. The clear, dry air of the desert and a diet of yogurt and salads had given him a period of easy breathing and untroubled digestion. But now, as the prospect of returning to civilization loomed nearer, he knew he would have to take up the fight again. He was very seasick during a short cruise to Greece, whose ruins did not impress him. Very sick, with colic in Constantinople, very seasick in the Black Sea, and had the asthma again while sailing up the Danube. By the time the Roosevelts arrived in Vienna on 19 April 1873, he was plainly depressed. Boredom weighed down heavily as his father plunged into preparations for the opening of the exposition, and his mother fussed over Bammy's European debut. "I bought a black cock and used up all my arsenic on him," wrote T.D. on 28 April. And on 11 May, "the last few weeks have been spent in the most dreary monotony. If I stayed here much longer, I should spend all my money on books and birds pour passer le temps." But his parents had arranged a better way for him to pass his time. At 10 p.m. on the 14th, we two boys, with father, left for Dresden, where we are to stay in a German family for the summer. It was Theodore Sr.'s typically bold intention to scatter the Roosevelts across Europe, while he himself completed his duties in Vienna and returned to America ahead of them. Perhaps he sensed that a period of mutual independence was necessary. Years of close-knit domesticity and the enforced claustrophobia of travel had brought them rather too much under his wing. The boys in particular would benefit. A certain coziness, verging on effeminacy, was discernible in their relations with their sisters and little motherling, and it was high time they were off on their own. He had accordingly arranged, through the American consul in Dresden, that they would study German and French there privately for 5 months. Mitty and Bammy would take the cures at Carlsbad and Frankensbad and shop in London and Paris. 11-year-old Corinne was told that she, too, was going to Dresden, but would live apart from T.D. and Elliot, so that the brothers and sister would not speak too much English together. Theodore Sr. soon came to regret this unconsciously cruel decision, and allowed the heart-stricken little girl to move in with the boys. Dresden was, in that peaceful heyday of the German Empire, one of the loveliest cities in the world. Its domes and spires and bridges, tremblingly reflected in the River Elbe, gave way on the one hand to mellow clusters of medieval housing, and on the other to the spacious estates of the rich. Beyond lay hills striped with vines and crowned with lush forests. The city's museums and libraries were full of masterpieces by Michelangelo, Raphael, Dante, and Goethe. Its court opera had known the batons of Weber and Wagner. Its zoological and mineralogical collections were unsurpassed in Europe. A general atmosphere of elegance and culture justly earned it the title of Florence on the Elbe. Here, in the finer part of town, Mitty was pleased to note, lived a genteel family named Minkwitz, who agreed to accommodate and instruct the young Roosevelts through the summer. Theodore Sr. could not have found a more typically Teutonic household. Herr Hofsrath Minkwitz was a member of the German Reichstag, imperious and stiffly formal. His wife was pink, plump, and hearty, a fount of cream teas and cakes. Their three daughters were gay, well-educated, and very temperamental, and their two sons were fierce-looking university students, much slashed about the face. Titi was predictably fascinated by this macabre pair. One, a famous swordsman, was called Der Rote Herzog, the Red Duke, and the other was nicknamed Er Nasehorn, Sir Rhinoceros, because the tip of his nose had been cut off in a duel and sewn on again. The Minkwitz family proved to be both hospitable and conscientious. No sooner had Theodore Sr. left town than they plunged the boys into a rigorous teaching schedule. "The plan of the day is this," wrote Titi at the end of the first month. "Half past six, up, and breakfast, which is through at half past seven, when we study till nine, repeat till half past 12, have lunch, and study till 3, when we take coffee, and have till tea, at 7, free. After tea, we study till 10, when we go back to bed. It is harder than I have ever studied before in my life, but I like it, for I really feel that I am making considerable progress." Fraulein Anna, the Minkwitz's eldest daughter, was placed in charge of Titi and Elliot, teaching them German grammar and arithmetic with unwearied patience. The rest of the family made a point of speaking German at all times, whether their young guests could understand them or not. Titi, it soon transpired, understood better than they realized. He caught several personal observations about the elder Roosevelts and gleefully retailed them by mail. Although he developed a fair measure of spoken fluency, he never was as easy with German prose as he was with French. However, he grew to love and enjoy German poetry almost as much as he did English. It was during this summer that he discovered the Nibelungenlied, whose Sturm und Drang evoked vague folk memories of his own Germanic ancestors. At first, Titi did not make a very agreeable impression upon his hosts. They looked askance at his long, wavy hair, his ink-spattered hands and ill-fitting clothes, from whose greasy recesses he was at any moment likely to produce a dead bat. "My scientific pursuits caused the family a good deal of consternation," he reported sadly. "My arsenic was confiscated and my mice thrown, with the tongs, out of the window." Undeterred, he continued to flay, pickle, and stuff a variety of local fauna. Whenever he could get out in the country, he collected specimens industriously and enlivened the household with hedgehogs and other small beasts and reptiles which persisted in escaping from partially closed bureau drawers. The skins of these unfortunate animals were allowed to festoon the exterior of the house with fine disregard for aesthetic effect. One night, during a thunderstorm so violent the Minkwitzes hid between their mattresses, Titi was heard to murmur in his sleep, "Oh, it is raining and my hedgehog will be all spoiled." During their free evenings and weekends, the young Roosevelts happily explored the parks and shops of Dresden and attended frequent performances of Shakespeare at the German theater. By coincidence, their cousins, John and Maud Elliott, were also living in the city, and the five little Americans soon became a gang, meeting every Sunday afternoon. Lest Theodore Sr. frown upon this socializing in English, they affected a cultural veneer, calling themselves the Dresden Literary American Club. Corinne spelled out their various creative roles. "I keep up the poetry part, Elliot and Johnny the tragical, and Titi the funny." Eventually, the last was beginning to fancy himself as a wit. His contributions to the club's copybooks, which have been preserved, strive mightily to imitate Dickens and Lewis Carroll, but the best that can be said of them is that they are long. His letters of the same period, written with the promptness and regularity that would always characterize him as a correspondent, are full of adolescent drollery, and since they are more spontaneous than his formal efforts, can still be read with pleasure. One of them, addressed to his mother, describes himself suffering from a familiar boyhood ailment. "Picture to yourself an antiquated woodchuck with his cheeks filled with nuts, his face well oiled, his voice hoarse from gargling, and a cloth resembling in texture and cleanliness a second-hand dustman's cast-off stocking around his head. Picture to yourself that, I say, and you will have a good-like likeness of your hopeful offspring while suffering from an attack of the mumps. Mitty may have been amused by that, but references in the same letter to recurring asthma and violent headaches were not so funny. She informed her husband that she would visit Dresden in August, and, if I find T.D. still with asthmatic feelings, I think I shall take him with me to Salzburg. Theodore Sr. was reluctant to interrupt the boy's studies, but he had just received a humorous letter himself, and it made poignant reading. I am at present suffering under a very slight attack of asthma. However, it is but a small attack, and except for the fact that I cannot speak without blowing up like an abridged edition of a hippopotamus, it does not inconvenience me much. We are now studying hard. Excuse my writing. The asthma has made my hand tremble awfully. When Mitty arrived in Dresden, she found he was sitting up to sleep again, just as he had as a child. His wheeze was perpetual, and his color was not good. She promptly bundled him off to a resort in the Swiss mountains, where his breathing cleared, only to be replaced by an ugly cough. It took 3 weeks in the pine-scented air of the Alps before he was well enough to return to his studies. He compensated for time lost to ill health by asking Fraulein Anna to speed up his lessons. "Of course I could not be left behind," Elliot reported, "so we were working harder than ever in our lives." T.D. was already showing the determination and inspirational qualities of a born leader. The Minkwitzes, who had gotten over their misgivings about him, openly admired his ability to concentrate on his books and his specimens to the exclusion of physical suffering. "I wonder what will become of my T.D.," pondered Mitty, as she prepared to depart again for England. "You need not be anxious about him," replied Fraulein Anna. "He will surely one day be a great professor, or who knows, he may become even President of the United States." Mitty was scornfully amused and unbelieving, but Fraulein Anna prided herself, in her old age, on being the first to predict T.D.'s future glory. Recrossing the Atlantic in late October, T.D. turned 15. He was now, if not yet a man, then at least a youth of more than ordinary experience of the world. He had traveled exhaustively in Britain, Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, visiting their great cities time and again, and actually living in some for long periods. He had plumbed the catacombs and climbed the Great Pyramid, slept in a monastery and toured a harem. He had hunted jackals on horseback, kissed the Pope's hand, stared into a volcano, traced an ancient civilization to its source, and followed the wanderings of Jesus. He had been exposed to much of the world's greatest art and architecture, become conversant in 2 foreign languages, and felt as much at home in Arab bazaars as at a German Kaffeeklatsch, or on the shaven lawns of an English estate. As is frequently the case with globe-trotting children, the very variety of T.D.'s knowledge put him at something of a disadvantage when it came to the requirements of formal education. His ambition was to enter Harvard in the fall of 1876, which meant he would have to be ready by the summer of 1875 to take a series of stiff entrance examinations. Strong as he might be in science, history, geography, and modern languages, he was weak in Latin, Greek, and mathematics. For the next 1.5 years, he would have to apply himself to these uncongenial subjects. Also, he would have to complete the building of his body. He was still too frail to think of going to boarding school. To go to Harvard, he must be able to compete, physically and mentally, with the finest young men in America. Theodore Sr. was confident, on the record of T.D.'s past accomplishments, that his challenge would be met and overcome. He had already retained an eminent tutor, Arthur Hamilton Cutler, to take charge of the boy's education. Nothing is known of the Roosevelt's reunion on the docks of Lower Manhattan, save that it took place on 5 November 1873. We may assume that it was joyous and that T.D.'s mood, as their carriage clattered up Broadway, was expectant. Instead of turning east toward the familiar row of brownstones on 20th Street, the horses continued north to the distant green of Central Park. Theodore Sr. had spent the last 5 months supervising the construction of a mansion at 6 West 57th Street on the outer fringes of New York City. Now in the prime of life, he was 42, a millionaire twice over, a founder of the Metropolitan and Natural History Museums, a patron of the New York Orthopedic Hospital and many charities, he wished to establish himself in appropriately grand surroundings. It seems like another landmark reached on my life's journey, he wrote Mitty after his first night in the new house. We have now probably one abiding place for the rest of our days. The mansion was designed by Russell Sturgis, New York's most fashionable architect. Although its blocky facade conformed with the townhouse style of the period, its interior furnishings were unusually rich, with heavy Persian rugs in every hall, sumptuous furniture, and much ornamental woodwork, including a hand-carved staircase. Knowing his wife's intolerance of anything artificial, Theodore Sr. had even gone to the length of ripping out a beautifully finished plaster ceiling and replacing it with real oak beams. There was a large museum in the garret for Teedy, and a fully equipped gymnasium on the top floor for all the children. Teedy lost no time in plunging into his new studies. He took an instant liking to Mr. Cutler, who in turn registered approval of the alert, vigorous character of young Roosevelt's mind. At first, Elliot and West Roosevelt, a cousin, joined in the lessons, but Teedy, working from 6 to 8 hours a day, soon left them behind, and they dropped out the following summer. From then on, he studied entirely alone. The young man never seemed to know what idleness was, wrote Cutler, long after his pupil had become president. Every leisure moment would find the last novel, some English classic or some abstruse book on natural history, in his hand. Although Teedy showed predictable excellence in science, history, German, and French, he did not neglect mathematics or the dry ancient languages. None of these, however, ever came easily to him. Throughout life, he was to mourn his inability to read Virgil and Homer in the original. He continued to study with such passion that Theodore Sr. worried about the effect on his health. Yet Teedy could not be restrained. Harvard, with its age-old aura of masculinity, intellectualism, and social success, floated ever nearer. He seemed to sense that, if the Grail eluded his reach, he might not have the strength to grasp it again. In the spring of 1874, the Roosevelts moved, as was their custom, into the country. Theodore Sr.'s growing desire to put down roots, symbolized by the townhouse on West 57th Street, led him this time in the direction of Oyster Bay, Long Island, where his father and brothers had long since established a family colony by the sea. Here he rented a gracious, plantation-style residence whose white columns and wide veranda no doubt appealed to Mitty's southern taste. The house, which was to become their permanent summer home, was called Tranquility. This name caused considerable amusement among friends and neighbors, for the Roosevelt way of life was anything but tranquil. From dawn to dusk, both house and garden resounded with activity. At any hour of the day, including breakfast time, Theodore Sr. might call upon his children for off-the-cuff speeches or recitations, whereupon they would roaringly oblige. Amateur theatricals were always being rehearsed or performed, practical jokes plotted, and violent obstacle races improvised, at great danger to life and limb. Teedy and Elliot took delight in blackening each other's eyes in boxing matches and collapsing, at unpredictable moments, into wrestling bouts which would continue until they were too exhausted to disentangle themselves. Invariably, these explosions of energy were followed by a general dash into the waters of Oyster Bay. We were all absolutely amphibious, recalled Bammy. And one of the old fishermen used to say he was pretty sure Dem Roosevelts were web-footed, as no one ever knew when we were in or out of the water. In the evening, they would read aloud from classics of history or literature, prompting discussions which would last far into the night. An extraordinary intimacy seemed to bind them together. They unashamedly hugged and kissed one another in spasms of mutual affection, which Mitty called melts. Since the children were all growing up rapidly, their individual personalities became more and more defined in this first summer at Tranquility. Bammy was kindly, capable, and domineering, already at 19 a poised hostess and socialite. Teedy, not yet 16, was still something of a scholarly recluse, yet when not bent over his books and birds, high-spirited and unaffected. 14-year-old Elliot was the most lovable of the Roosevelts, a budding Apollo with an eye for the girls, and 12-year-old Corrine, mercurial and gushy, had already begun her lifelong career as a composer of sentimental poetry. Understandably, some of the more staid members of New York society considered the Roosevelts eccentric. Others, such as the teenage Fanny Smith, an early admirer of Teedy, found them a family so rarely gifted that it seemed touched with the flame of divine fire. With Edith Carroll, ripening now into attractive adolescence, she became one of many regulars who stayed at Oyster Bay every summer and attended a weekly dance class at Dodsworth's ballroom during the New York social season. Although it may be presumed that T.D. was not insensitive to the appeal of the opposite sex in 1874 and 1875, he makes approving references to girls in his letters and admits that he enjoys dancing, his main interests continued to be study and exercise. Not even his triumph in the preliminary Harvard entrance examinations of July 1875, "Is it not splendid? I passed in all the 8 subjects I tried," was allowed to affect the inflexible program he had devised for himself. 4 times a year he took a recess of a week to 10 days, but even these breaks were doggedly purposeful. He would head for the lakes of the Adirondacks or the woods of Long Island in New Jersey, collecting specimens and data and loping for miles, gun in hand, after wild game. He described one such excursion to Edith's summer place at Seabright as being full of ornithological enjoyment and reptilian rapture. His battle for health would appear to have been mostly won by the end of 1875. A sporting calendar has been preserved, which records that from 21 August through 11 December, he engaged his brother and several male cousins in a series of 15 athletic contests, running, jumping, vaulting, wrestling, and boxing, and won 14 of them, drawing the other one. On 1 November, he noted his physical measurements: chest, 34 inches, waist, 26.5 inches, thigh, 20 inches, calf, 12.5 inches, neck, 14.5 inches, shoulders, 41 inches, arms up, 10.5 inches, arms straight, 9¾ inches, forearm, 10 inches, weight, 124 pounds, height, 5 feet 8 inches. From this, and from the description of others, we can conjure up the picture of a skinny, sunburned boy, just 17 years old, with wiry muscles and a clean glow of health about him. Occasional attacks of asthma still came and went, but did not bother him unduly. He affected a pair of side whiskers, which emphasized the hard thrust of his jaw. His mouth, during moments of thoughtfulness, clamped like a band of blued steel. At other times, when he allowed his natural humor to bubble over, it seemed to consist of nothing but perfectly white teeth. Although he was not handsome, he was an attractive youngster, and Fanny Smith, for one, adored him unashamedly. She was convinced that he would become president and said as much to her sister. But the prophecy seems to have been as skeptically received as Fraulein Anna's 2 years before. In particular, Fanny worshipped his courage and high-mindedness. Some of her friends found him priggish, but she felt only a sunny charm, which still warmed her when she was an old woman of 89. As I look back to those early days, perhaps the characteristic that made at the time the strongest appeal was the unquenchable gaiety which seemed to emanate from his whole personality. This quality was a noticeable family trait, but in Theodore it seemed to reach its height and to invigorate the atmosphere about him to an unusual degree. As a young girl, I remember dreading to sit next to him at any formal dinner, lest I become so convulsed with laughter at his whispered sallies as to disgrace myself and be forced to leave the room. That Fanny herself was something of a rival to Edith Carrow is implied in another passage from her memoirs. She describes a winter afternoon when Elliot, always more forthcoming than T.D., paid her and her sisters a courtly visit. While chatting in a window seat, she suddenly noticed T.D., looking blue with cold, walking rapidly up and down outside. "Why, Elliot, do you see Theodore out there? Why doesn't he come in?" I exclaimed. Elliot replied, and to this day the incident remains a mystery, that Theodore also had planned a visit, but that suddenly he had been overcome by bashfulness and had decided to remain outside. We brought him in, where he became, as always, the life and soul of the party. But the incident reminds me of the unexpected strain of self-depreciation which surprised one through the years. Much less is known of the relationship between Edith and T.D., except that it deepened steadily into intimacy during the summer of 1876, his last before entering college. Having completed the equivalent of 3 years of college preparation in less than 2, he could finally relax and allow his social personality to develop. He would gallantly row her across Oyster Bay, in the hottest sun, over the roughest water, in the smallest boat, and Edith tolerated it with her usual inscrutable sweetness. They would read and recite endlessly to each other, Edith showing a decided preference for belles lettres, Titi for rhythmic poetry and warlike heroic prose. Years after, family tradition would hold that these two had an understanding by the time he went up to Harvard in the fall, but if so, there is no formal record of it. Nevertheless, seeds had been sown, and some sort of future flowering seemed assured. Chapter 3. The Man with the Morning in His Face. Trained for either camp or court, skillful in each manly sport, young and beautiful and tall, art of warfare, craft of chases, swimming, skating, snowshoe races, excellent alike in all. On the night of 26 October 1876, the normally quiet streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts were disturbed by the roars of a student demonstration. Freshman supporters of the Republican candidate for president stamped on the cobblestones and echoed a shout that could be heard in electoral districts across the nation. Hurrah for Hayes and honest ways! Torchlight flickered redly on their optimistic faces and waving banners. After 8 years of governmental scandals under the Grant administration, it seemed at last that civil service reform, so dear to the hearts of young progressives, was on the way. The United States, just one century old, stood thrillingly poised, like themselves, at the threshold of maturity. There was a crackle of excitement in the fall air, a promise of power and future glory. The demonstrators were in great good humor, and not altogether in earnest. One lopsided banner called for free trade, free press, and free beer. All at once, from a second-story window, came the jeering voice of a Democratic senior. "Hush up, you blooming freshman!" Albert Bushnell Hart, who was in the crowd, noted the effect of this insult upon his classmates, and upon one of them in particular. Every student there was profoundly indignant. I noticed one little man, small but firmly knit. He had slammed his torch to the street. His fists quivered like steel springs and swished through the air as if plunging a hole through a mattress. I had never seen a man so angry before. "It's Roosevelt from New York," someone said. I made an effort to know Roosevelt better from that moment. According to other accounts, a potato came whizzing in the little man's direction, and his language in reply was unprintable. A trifling incident, perhaps, but the Hayes demonstration was the first sign of any political interest in young Theodore. It happened to occur on the eve of his 18th birthday. He had been at Harvard for only 1 month. Cambridge, in 1876, was essentially the same peaceful village it had been for more than 200 years. The occasional shriek of a horse car's wheels around a sharp corner, the slap of cement on bricks, the hiss of hydraulic dredges down by the marsh, warned that a noisier age was on its way, but as yet these sounds only accentuated the general sleepy calm, so soothing to academic nerves. In the center of the village stood the ivy-hung buildings of Harvard Yard, widely spaced with lawns and gravel walks, securely surrounded with iron railings, an oasis within an oasis. Through these railings could be glimpsed the intellectual elite of New England, men whose very nomenclature suggested the social exclusiveness and inbred quality of America's oldest cultural institution. The 800 students of Harvard College echoed, in their dress, mannerisms, and behavior, the general parochial atmosphere. Although President Eliot's revolutionary new administrative policies had freed them from the hidebound conformity of former years, they still tended to wear the same soft round hats and pea jackets, quote the same verses of Omar Khayyam, smoke the same meerschaum pipes, walk with the Harvard swing, actually an indolent saunter, and speak with the Harvard drawl, with its characteristic hint of suppressed yawns. Their pose of fashionable languor was dropped only on evenings across the river, when they would drink huge quantities of iced shandygaff in Bowdoin Square and make loud nuisances of themselves at variety shows in the Globe Theater. They cultivated a laissez-faire attitude to the outside world and its problems, elegantly summarized by George Pellew, class poet of Theodore's senior year, in his Ode to Indifference. "We deem it narrow-minded to excel. We call the man fanatic who applies his life to one grand purpose till he dies. Enthusiasm sees one side, one fact. We try to see all sides, but do not act. We long to sit with newspapers unfurled, indifferent spectators of the world." These lines do not appear to have offended the future apostle of the life strenuous, when he heard them recited at the Hasty Pudding Club. He had other things on his mind at the time. Even so, it is surprising that he did not react to them as furiously as he did to the jeer and the whizzing potato of the Hayes demonstration. No philosophy, certainly, could be more foreign to his ardent nature than that of indifference. As president, he would wax apoplectic over much milder material. The truth is that Roosevelt from New York was much more comfortable with the languid fops of Harvard than his apologists would admit. He not only relished the company of rich young men, but moved at once into the ranks of the richest and most arrogantly fashionable. Within a week of his arrival in Cambridge, he forsook the bread-slinging camaraderie of meals at Commons and joined a dining club composed almost exclusively of Boston Brahmins. Showing the self-protective instinct of a born snob, he carefully researched the antecedents of potential friends. "On this very account," he wrote Corinne, "I have avoided being very intimate with the New York fellows." Although his class numbered some 250, each of whom could, on graduation day, consider himself privileged above 50,000 American youths, Theodore considered only a minute fraction to be the gentleman sort, and took little notice of the rest. But his personality was too warm and his manners too good for him to ignore them completely. "Roosevelt was perfectly willing to talk to others," recalled a member of the lower orders, "when the occasion arose." As a result of this attitude, his popularity at Harvard was confined to the minority who could call him Teddy. Partly because he gave so little of himself to the majority, and partly because the variety of his interests kept him constantly on the move, vignettes of him during those early days at Cambridge are sketchy and dissimilar. Yet all are vivid. He trots around Holmes Field in a bright red football jersey, the man with the morning in his face. Flushing with indignation, he leaps to his feet during roll call and protests harshly the mispronunciation of his name. He drops from a horse car in the square, thin-chested, spectacled, nervous, and frail. He hunches over a book in a room full of noisy students, frowning with absorption, oblivious to horseplay around his chair, and to the fact that his boots are being charred by the fire. He stands in the door of Memorial Hall, talking vehemently, stammering, baring his teeth. He actually runs from one recitation to another, although it is not considered Harvard form to move at more than walking speed. Again and again, he leaps to his feet at lectures, challenging statements and demanding clarifications, until a professor shouts angrily, "See here, Roosevelt, let me talk. I'm running this course." Perhaps the most revealing anecdote is that of Richard Welling, who was, at this time, the strongest student in the records of Harvard Gymnasium. His first impression of Theodore was a youth in the kindergarten stage of physical development, drearily swinging between vertical poles. Later that winter, when the youth invited him to go skating in bitter weather, Welling changed his mind. Theodore escorted him to Fresh Pond, which was too big and too unprotected from the furious winds to be good skating ground, rough ice, dull skates, wretched skaters scuffling about, mostly arms waving like windmills in a gale, and when any sane man would have voted to go home, as the afternoon sport was clearly a flop, Roosevelt was exclaiming, "Isn't this bully?" And the harder it blew, and the more we skated, the more often I had to hear, "Isn't this bully?" There was no trace of shelter where we could rub our ears, restore our fingers to some resemblance of feeling, or prevent our toes from becoming perhaps seriously frostbitten. Never in college was my own grit so put to the test, and yet I would not be the first to suggest home. Nearly 3 hours passed before Roosevelt finally said, "It's too dark to skate anymore," as though, if there had been a moon, we could have gone on to midnight. I recall my numbed fingers grasping the key to my room and unable to make a turn in the lock. That afternoon of so-called sport made me realize Roosevelt's amazing vitality. Theodore Sr., admitting to an almost sinful interest in his son's progress, worried sometimes about the physical phenomenon he had helped create. "His energy seems so superabundant that I fear it may get the better of him in one way or another." Clearly, the young man was going to have to do something about his temper. Arguments at his eating club provoked him to furious volleys of food throwing, and on one occasion he slammed a whole pumpkin down on the head of an adversary. He reacted to personal abuse with instant fisticuffs, even punching friends who tried to restrain him. At first, the social butterflies of Harvard did not know what to make of this hornet in their midst. His name was too foreign, his manner too bumptious to win instant acceptance. However, it did not take the Minots and Saltonstalls and Chapins long to discover that he was the brother of Bammy Roosevelt, the charming Knickerbocker who had summered in Bar Harbor, Maine, the last few years, and that his bumptiousness was a side effect of his uncontrolled enthusiasms. They found it hard to dislike someone so supremely unconscious of his own peculiarity. Teddy happened to be a fascinating, if spluttery, talker. He could analyze lightweight boxing techniques, discuss the aerodynamics of birds and the protective coloration of animals, quoted Will from the Nibelungenlied and the speeches of Abraham Lincoln, and explain what it was like trying to remain submerged in the Dead Sea. He was queer. He was crazy. He was a bundle of eccentricities. But he was wholly interesting. It was the custom in those days for members of Harvard's more exclusive clubs to wander through the streets after election meetings and serenade each new addition to their roles. At least a dozen times during the years 1876 to 80, the name that floated up through the night air was that of Theodore Roosevelt, Jr. Fearing the dampness of ground-floor dormitories to which freshmen were traditionally assigned, Theodore took a room on the second floor of Mrs. Richardson's boarding house at 16 Winthrop Street, about halfway between the Yard and the Charles River. Furnished and decorated by Bammy, it was already just as cozy and comfortable as it could look when he moved in on 27 September 1876. Four big windows facing north and east supplied all the light an amateur taxidermist could wish for. The walls were tastefully papered, the carpet deep and warm. Cushions and a heavy fur rug awaited him on the chaise longue. There were his birds under domes of glass and his bowie knives crossed over the mantel. A massively carved table stood in the center of the room, under the gas jet, along with the hard, bare chair which New Englanders considered appropriate for study. Theodore gazed about him in delight. "When I get my pictures and books," he assured Bammy, "I do not think there will be a room in college more handsome." As he settled in and felt for the first time the joy of adulthood, he overflowed with gratitude to the parents who had brought him thus far. "It seems perfectly wonderful," he wrote Mitty, "looking back over my 18 years of existence, to see how I have literally never spent an unhappy day unless by my own fault. When I think of this, and also of my intimacy with you all, for I hardly know a boy who is on as intimate and affectionate terms with his family as I am, I feel I have an immense amount to be thankful for." Another letter, dating from the early months of his freshman year, is full of documentary detail. "Perhaps you would like me to describe completely one day of college life. So I shall take last Monday. At 7:30, my scout, having made the fire and blacked the boots, calls me, and I get round to breakfast at 8. Only a few of the boys are at breakfast, most having spent the night in Boston. Our quarters now are nice and sunny, and the room is prettily papered and ornamented. For breakfast, we have tea or coffee, hot biscuits, toast, chops or beefsteak, and buckwheat cakes. After breakfast, I study till 10, when the mail arrives and is eagerly inspected. From 11 to 12, there is a Latin recitation with a meek-eyed professor who calls me Roosevelt. Hardly anyone can get my name correctly, except as Rosie. Then I go over to the gymnasium, where I have a set to with the gloves with General Lister, the boxing master, for I am training to box among the lightweights in the approaching match for the championship of Harvard. Then comes lunch, at which all the boys are assembled in an obstreperously joyful condition. A state of mind which brings on a free fight to the detriment of Harry Jackson, who, with a Dutch cheese and some coffee cups, is put under the table, which proceeding calls forth dire threats of expulsion from Mrs. Morgan. Afterwards, studying and recitation took up the time till 4:30. As I was then going home, suddenly I heard, "Hi, Ted! Catch!" and a baseball whizzed by me. Our two babies, Bob Bacon and Arthur Hooper, were playing ball behind one of the buildings, so I stayed and watched them until the ball went through a window and a proctor started out to inquire, when we abruptly separated. That evening, I took dinner with Mr. and Mrs. Tudor, and had a very pleasant home-like time. When I returned, I studied for an hour, and then, it being 10:30, put on my slippers, which are as comfortable as they are pretty, drew the rocking chair up to the fire, and spent the next half hour toasting my feet and reading Lamb. From time to time, as Theodore sat writing, he could glance over his shoulder and see the firelight reflected in the eyes of salamanders. He had established an impromptu vivarium in the corner of the room, where animals awaiting execution had an opportunity to review their past lives. At first, this collection was small enough to reassure his landlady, but its population gradually expanded to include snakes, lobsters, and a giant tortoise. The latter managed to escape from its pen while Theodore was out and wandered through the house in search of freedom. Mrs. Richardson, stumbling upon it, was frightened into hysterics. Rooseveltian eloquence presumably saved the day, for Theodore continued to reside at 16 Winthrop Street throughout his college career. In addition to boxing, wrestling, bodybuilding, and his daily hours of recitation, the young freshman attended weekly dancing classes, hunted in the woods around Cambridge, taught in Sunday school, stuffed and dissected his specimens, organized a whist club, took part in poetry reading sessions, followed the Harvard football team to Yale. The fellows seemed to be a much more scrubby set than ours, and in time-honored undergraduate fashion, caroused with his friends, making the night hideous with his harsh, unmusical singing. He developed a sudden and ardent interest in the girls of Boston, and thanks to his excellent local connections, was soon seeing many of them. Hardly a week went by in those early months of 1877 without its round of matinees, theater parties, and balls. Theodore reported them all enthusiastically to his family, along with assurances that he was not neglecting his studies, and at least one guilty protestation that he remained faithful to Edith Carroll. Although he had not lacked for female company hitherto in his life, it had been confined mostly to the Roosevelt family circle. Even his intimacy with Edith had the quality of a brother-sister relationship. Sickly and reclusive as a child, preoccupied with travel and self-improvement in his teens, he had had little opportunity to knock on strange doors. Now, doors were opening of their own accord, disclosing scores of fresh faces and alluring young figures. Understandably, Theodore was dazzled. Almost every girl he met is described in his letters as sweet, bright, or pretty. What the girls thought of him, with his crooked spectacles, grinning teeth, and alarmingly frank conversation, was another matter. The evidence is that they tolerated him. To one debutante, he was studious, ambitious, eccentric, not the sort to appeal at first, until they found they had grown fond of him. It might be mentioned here that neither during his student years, nor indeed at any time in his life, did Theodore show the slightest tolerance for women, or for that matter men, who were anything but rigidly virtuous. His judgments of people lower down the moral or social scale could be particularly prudish. "Have just received a letter telling me that Cousin Cornelius has distinguished himself by marrying a French actress," he wrote in his diary one day. "He is a disgrace to the family, the vulgar brute." Sex, to him, was part of the mystical union of marriage, and however pleasurable as an act of love, its function was to procreate. Outside marriage, as far as he was concerned, it simply did not exist. Of the inclinations that naturally beset a young man when he returns, hot from the intimacies of a sleigh ride, to his private room, it is perhaps unnecessary to speak. There are erasures and pages torn out of Theodore's diaries, yet also the ecstatic declaration when he finally fell in love, "Thank heaven, I am perfectly pure." At the same time that he became a ladies' man, he developed into something of a fashion plate, or as he preferred to describe himself, very swell. Invited away for the weekend, he was suddenly ashamed of his hat and sent home for a beaver. Selecting a new wardrobe, he agonized for days over his afternoon coat, being undecided whether to have it a frock or a cutaway. He complained that his washerwoman did not act squarely on the subject of white cravats. He sported one necktie so brilliant it cast a glow upon his cheeks, and combed his whiskers until they swayed in the breeze. Sniggers could be heard in the yard as he marched dazzlingly by. But Theodore, in the manner of all dandies, pretended not to notice he was being noticed. When he assured his parents that he was not neglecting his studies, he was telling the truth. Indeed, he got through prodigious quantities of work. Iron self-discipline had become a habit with him, and he plodded every day with the methodism of a Wesleyan minister. The amount of time he spent at his desk was comparatively small, rarely more than a quarter of the day, but his concentration was so intense and his reading so rapid that he could afford more time off than most. Even these free periods were packed with mental, physical, or social activity. "He was forever at it," said one classmate. Another marveled, "Never have I seen or read of a man with such an amazing array of interests." Tumbling into bed at midnight or in the small hours, Theodore could luxuriate in healthy tiredness, satisfied that he had wasted